This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guest today is Gabriel Schwacke. Gabriel is the author of Dwelling on the Green Line, Privatize and Rule in Israel-Palestine, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Concealed within the walls of settlements along the Green Line, the border between Israel and the occupied West Bank is a complex history of territoriality, privatization, and multifaceted class dynamics. Since the late 1970s, the state aimed to expand the heavily populated coastal area eastwards into the occupied Palestinian territories, granting favored groups of individuals, developers, and entrepreneurs the ability to influence the formation of built space as a means to continuously develop and settle national frontiers. As these settlements developed, they became a physical manifestation of a relationship between the political interest to control space and the ability to form it. Telling a social, political, and economic story from an architectural and urban history perspective, the author, Gabriel Schwacke, shows how this production of space can be seen not only as a cultural phenomenon, but also as one that is deeply entangled with geopolitical agendas. But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Gabriel, welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me here, Roberto. I'm really happy to join you in this conversation.
First question, can you tell us something about yourself? And I think listeners will be fascinated by your very interesting personal story, and also about the origins of the book.
It's hard for me to decide where to start from, my profession, my background, my personal one, but I usually start with my profession for some reason, not that I think that it's the most important thing. So I'm a trained architect and urban designer, eventually turned historian. I was born in Galilee, Northern Galilee, and was raised in Nazareth and also a little bit in Haifa. And I then moved to Tel Aviv to do my studies and my work. I'm currently an assistant professor of architecture, history, and heritage studies at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. That's where now I live and conduct my everyday life. So after studying architecture at Tel Aviv University, I began, my first steps as a practitioner. And I was really looking forward to being involved, in social housing projects and, to tackle the issues of urban living and sustainable everyday life. That was, my main focus. But I was recurrently amazed, from the influence that questions of marketability, investment, speculations, on real estate considerations, the scope of influence that they have on both urban and architectural design processes. So that's why I decided to start with a doctoral project on this topic, trying to take this historical tipping point in which these values began to prevail and eventually led me to writing this book.
I'm interested about the structure of the book and the goals. So this is a book about planning, architecture, and economy. And I was wondering if you can describe for us the main goals of your narrative.
So in general, as I said before, I wanted to understand how architecture and cities are influenced by economy. Yeah. So mainly by issues that go beyond questions of culture, customs, traditional ways of life. And here, the area that I'm focusing on, the area along the Green Line, that is called the border between the pre-67 Israel and the occupied West Bank, for me it was here the collaboration between the state and its territorial interests and private agents, which presented a different way to look at things. And these private agents, whether they're individuals, construction companies, or larger investors. And what I was amazed to see is how the first, the state, was dictating where new settlements should be built. And it was the private market, the latter, that received the ability to dictate how these settlements would eventually look like. So let's say the state was drawing ink stains on the map. It was the private sector who was translating these ink stains into concrete settlements. So eventually, for me, it was the idea of seeing how economy would, together combined with state interests, dictated, let's say, the streets, the urban layouts, and also the houses that these settlements comprise, and so on and so on. So going into eventually the inner design of a specific dwelling unit.
Now, you talked about the Green Line. So I want to, keep this conversation for a few minutes about geography, because in the book you talk about a very important area, let's call it that, like that, which is the Trans-Israel Highway. And, perhaps you can define this and what is the importance in your book, and also in terms of like the real impact of this idea.
I agree with you. We should explain this, let's say the importance of this area. So I would go a step back first, and I would say that if my interest was to detect this historical tipping point, the question when we're doing historical research is, what is our focus? So what is our case study? And I started looking at this area mainly as a case study. And so, as I said, I was, before embarking on an academic career, was living in Tel Aviv, say in my pre-doc days. And I would then take the car to visit my parents up north in Nazareth every other week. And I would drive them along the Trans-Israel Highway, road number 6, as it's also known. And thanks to that road, instead of driving for 2.5 hours, it would take me an hour and a half. If as long as you're not going through rush hour, then it could take you also 4 or 5 hours. And driving along this incredible piece of infrastructure, it's hard not to realize the construction boom that this area has witnessed and is now continuing to witness, this constant development of different real estate projects. But at the same time, when driving along this highway, we always need to remember that it's a bit adjacent to the Green Line. Most of the construction in this area began taking place since the late 1970s, so after the occupation of the West Bank, as a means to enhance the state's control of this former border area, and eventually also to create a territorial sequence between what we call Israel proper and the settlements in the occupied territories. And this happened then parallel to the privatization of the local economy. So this area then formed for me the ideal case study to examine the spatial manifestation of state-led privatization.
I want to stay again on the question of your methodological approach as we located the area of your research and obviously the object of your research. I want to ask about the question of power. Power is at the center of your methodological approach. And so I was wondering if you can tell us more about your theoretical background, which does really include questions about economy, architecture, history, planning, and also the sources that you have used.
Power is indeed a central concept in this book and in my writing in general. Of course, we always, when thinking about space and power, immediately go to theorists like, Foucault and other French contemporaries. But I actually chose to make a more, Marxist approach to power, so relying on the concepts of modes, relations, and means of production, and then focusing mainly on the work of the Frankfurt School, so the so-called the neo-Marxists, so Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, and these fellows, who explain how power relations endure over time and how they transform while also transforming culture with them. And I think this is how we see today the idea of power as more as a diffused system, so a series of coalitions between different interest groups. This is why I chose also to use Kim Dovey's distinction between the power over, so how to control something or someone, and the power to, so to be able to do something. And I coupled that with the concept of spatial privilege, which I developed according to space stratification theory of Alba, Logan, Moloch, and others, that refers to the ability of specific, usually favored groups to influence the process of spatial production. So it's the idea of seeing power in space, not just, you know, as this straightforward conspiracy, but a set of processes that in a way correlate, contradict, but endure over time.
Let's move forward with the book. And I want to start talking about chapter two. So chapter two is an historical chapter, essentially. It deals with the question of built space, and it offers a very interesting discussion in relation to key terms like territory and territoriality. Can you speak about the idea of a territorial project in relation to Israel and how it evolved since the beginning of the 20th century?
I think this is the way to look at Israeli territoriality. Yeah. So when we're dealing with a subject, I think we needed to look at it in a perspective or a prism of 150 years at least. Seeing it as a process that began in the second half of the 19th century with the construction of the first Zionist settlements in Palestine, you know, the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah. And here we have to mention that there isn't one Zionist ideology, yeah, but actually a catalog of different Zionist ideologies. Nevertheless, the prevailing one was that saw Palestine as the land without people, to the people without land, which needs then to be redeemed through settlement and agriculture. And while we hardly have any agriculture today, we still see how strong this idea is, even in 2023. The need, you know, to secure control over the land by the construction of new settlements. So applying a Marxist perspective, we see how this evolved together with the changes in the relations of production. So starting with agricultural settlements in the pre-statehood years, then moving to industrial towns in the 50s and 60s, and then community settlements, and then suburbs in the 80s and 90s, and to what we have today, this hybrid of high-rise suburbia that we see from Modi'in to Maale Adumim and all the way to Harish in the north.
I'm interested in a concept that you discuss in this chapter, the question of a domestication of the eastern frontier. Can you elaborate on this particular idea?
When starting the research, I didn't even think of the frontier, and then my dear friend and colleague and Chaim Jacobi told me, no, you have to think of the idea of frontier. And so we have to also think of the definition of what a frontier is, which is usually this idea that's perceived as being exempted from the norm, so not fully incorporated into the societal consensus or what we call the subtle psyche, either because it's far away, not settled, contested, or settled by people who are not from the ruling hegemony. So domesticating the frontier then is precisely the act of making it an undisputed part of the national consensus. And in the case of Israel-Palestine, it is through the act of settlement, but not any settlement, many ones that are affiliated as not too religious or extremist, but rather ones that are secular, belonging to the veteran sector of Israeli society, when through this specific group, then an area is fully domesticated and turned from a frontier into part of the consensus.
And I think we should say that for listeners who are not familiar with the geography of Israel, since you talked about earlier road number six, particularly in the northern section, it's really a border kind of road, because when you drive, you actually are bordering the West Bank, and you can see the wall separating Israel and Palestine. So It's not just an ideal frontier. It's not something imaginary line, but actually it's a real line that divides two people.
Yes, exactly. And there were some attempts, perhaps not deliberate, but you see that when you're driving around Kalkilia and Tulkarem, how there were the separation wall was hidden by trees. So you don't really see the separation wall. And one cannot wonder, one cannot avoid wondering whether that was intentional or not, you know, to make you forget that you're dealing with this, that you're driving along a contested area and just enjoying, you know, the 21st style century of infrastructure.
I would be very cynical and argue that probably it was done on purpose, but, you know, we should collect evidence to prove the case. But exactly. Knowing the history of deleting evidence of the past, particularly after 1948, with the creation of forest in some parts of, you know, the basically areas that were inhabited by Palestinians, villages and small rural areas. So one can, you know, connect the other. But of course, it's much more complex than that. And chapter three focuses on the community settlements, which you call a neo-rural phenomenon. And you're looking at several case studies. So I was wondering if you can, first of all, explain, you know, what is a community settlement? What do you mean by neo-rural phenomenon? And, you know, you can link this with one or two of the examples that you discuss in the book. So you can give us a sense of their evolution and how they evolved up to today.
Well, actually, neo-rural is actually one of the concepts that I'm really glad that I was able to apply to the context of Israel-Palestine, because I believe in a way it is short-lived, this the neo-rural reality of community settlements, but I think it plays a key role in how these things developed. Because yeah, we think of this community settlements, in Hebrew they're called Mushavim Kehilatim, or Yishuvim Kehilatim, which emerged, let's say, during the 1970s in the West Bank, but also in Galilee, the famous Judaization of Galilee, the Mitzpim project. And initially, they were not suburban. We perceive them today as suburban settlements, but they did not start as suburban settlements. Because we have to remember that suburban living comprises a big private house outside of the city, but also a daily commute to the city. So the connection to the urban center is therefore never lost. And we need to remember that these areas that we're dealing with, you know, either Upper Galilee or the West Bank, were not that well connected to the main metropolises during the 1970s and also during the early 1980s. And actually, this detachment from urban centers is exactly what city dwellers that were moving to these areas were looking for. So to be disconnected, to get in touch with nature, to develop an alternative and somehow communal lifestyle, highly resembling the early kibbutzim and mushabim, but also a bit different, I'd say, in a way, quite also new age. Because we have to remember that at that time, so late 1970s, early 80s, agriculture in Israel started diminishing. It became less and less important. And these new settlements had either very little settlement, mainly because there were also no farming lands available. We have to remember, in the context of the West Bank, the Israel is able to claim uncultivated areas as public lands and then to use them for settlement. So usually these would be the areas not properly available, or not, let's say, usable for farming purposes. So in that sense, they cannot be agricultural settlements. But that's only one issue. We have also to remember that the city boys and girls that were moving to these new settlements also lacked the needed experience. But also, I think in the larger context, the historical one, early 1980s, we see agriculture began disappearing from Israel, mainly the small-scale one that these settlements could have developed. So we see here this peculiar combination of a rural settlement, yet without any agricultural functions. And this is what we had, for example, in Salit and Rehan, two settlements in the West Bank, one in the northern West Bank, one just you know, just in the center, which today are quite suburban, but they actually began as moshavim and then gradually turned into community settlements. And today we see that they became totally suburban just when the roads arrived, especially road number 6. So turning them from frontier settlements, but in the process of more than 20 years, into what we know them today, in a way quite livable and accommodating family-oriented settlements with high living standards.
It just made me think about the fact that on the other hand, some of these old-style neo-rural settlements have been developing in the south of Israel, particularly in the Negev, where you have, again, connected to idea of, sort of a different kind of living, and you have these small communities off the grid that they try to be isolated and, you know, they're connected to obviously a new age ideology and so forth. But that's a kind of a different development. One thing that I think is very important is that obviously community settlements were at the beginning connected also to a sort of a socialist ideology. And so they, again, they're a community, they bring people in, they work together. But in the same chapter, you talk about the next step, which is the individualization process. So the idea that the individual becomes more important than the group. And so I was wondering if you can tell us more about this individualization process and how it's reflected in the economic and political changes that unfolded in Israel.
Well, as many of us know, Israel is founded on a national identity with strong communal aspects. Socialism was really influential. And this was true for both rural settlements like the kibbutzim and moshavim, but also in the urban context. Even if it was not really carried out and it has sectarian aspects to it, this was at least the main and the formal ideology. And architecture and urban planning, when we're talking about architecture and urban planning, we see this in the communal settlements, but also in housing estates built in different development towns, how they were all made out of small family units sharing a common open space. Okay, I don't say kibbutzim, you have this big lawn with all the small units around it, or let's say even in the modernist housing estates with the small dwelling units in one communal house, and then laid out also in one shared open space. But the privatization of Israel brought this growing focus on the individual and his or her family. This is not why we can be surprised. We see that the emergence of the private house with the fence and the garden, and made also the introvert apartment building developing just parallel to this process. I once tried to call this Americanization of Israel, or perhaps I think the individualization is perhaps, a better term to define this phenomenon.
Now, moving forward, you talk about the process of gentrification, which is also connected, obviously, with this idea of individualization. So moving away from this community, a process actually of gentrification that I personally witnessed firsthand in my 20 years of regular visits to Israel. You are making the case that suburban settlements were and are, I believe, part of a new phase in the national geopolitical project. You also use a very powerful image, the domestication of a green line. Gentrification, however, occurs if you have a middle class eager to transform their lifestyle.
I think gentrification is, in general, a very exciting topic to deal with, mainly because of the common misconception that we have on it worldwide. We see this, as this is perceived usually this spontaneous process, starting with artists and bohemians, moving into a rundown neighborhood, and then turning it to this hip place, and then come the young professionals, and then the families, and even then a richer clientele that eventually replace the existing community. And this is how we perceive it or discuss it, whether we're living in Soho or London or Berlin today, or Tel Aviv, Jaffa. So this is, let's say, the global approach to it. This is never actually a spontaneous process. It's not me, as many other researchers have discussed this. It's rather, let's say, a part of a well-coordinated process intended to develop areas through their social transformation. So it's actually by bringing in people, certain groups, enabling them to develop a certain area that, say, establishment institutions promote then the development of certain areas. And this is what I saw that was happening, or happened at least in, along the Green Line during the 1980s. So I was perhaps in a way forced to call it a process of gentrification, because I was seeing how this, by bringing the secular upper middle class, the veteran secular upper middle class, into this area, it was then domesticated. And those were usually city dwellers, you know, from strong socio-political affiliations, either through party membership, military roles, or other, let's say, affiliations in terms of unions and so on, who received then the opportunity to build their own communities in the area. And that might sound like, let's say, former examples, but this was totally different. And we don't have any communal features here now, but rather suburban layouts with large villas, fences, and of course roads meant to facilitate this daily commute to the city that we discussed earlier. And we see this in both sides of the Green Line, yeah? So either Alfe Menashe, which is inside the West Bank, or Kochabir, which is just a border with the best back, and they were all initiated for or by young urban families with an influential affiliation, as we mentioned. So Alfe Menashe started as a settlement for military officers, and Kochabir started as for members of the youngsters of the Chiyut party, the Likud party, but also then also unions and military officers as well. And so when these influential youngsters came to the Green Line, they were able to transform it into the place where the local political and cultural hegemony lives, turning into, let's say, a part of the national consensus, a place where others could or would like to live in as well.
You just mentioned Kochabir here, and I was wondering if you can give us a better sense of the development of this village, now small town. Because I think it's a very good example of this kind of gentrification, how these places by the border change in time, and also, you know, saw the arrival of new people linked to a particular ideology and represent the political goals of a state or a particular government, better saying.
Well, Kochabir is a fascinating case study just because it is so simple in a way, the way in which it was developed. It started as an initiative of the youngsters of the Chiyut movement, mainly Michael Eitan was the head of the youngsters of the Chiyut movement then, later parliament member and also minister, and they were looking for a place to settle, preferably in the West Bank, not more than 40 minutes car drive to Tel Aviv. This is quote unquote, not more than 40 minutes. And then they decided to meet with Ariel Sharon, who was then the Minister of Agriculture. He told them, and this is all through interviews with Michael Eitan, he told them, well, why don't you take this place? It's not in the West Bank, but it is near what was called the small triangle. So the Arab towns inside Israel, west of the Green Line. And he said, yeah, that we have, it has its own national importance because we have to prevent, the sphere of the territorial sequence between Arab sequence, the cross-border one, and the youngsters agreed, and this is how they received the plot. And then then became, you know, this in a way, I would not call it turf battle, but you can call it turf battle of different associations connected to the ruling regime. Then it was Likud. So it was the youngsters of the Chawut movement, but also military officers of the Ministry of Defense, and also different Zionist associations, mainly the Zionist Association of South Africa, who gets more plots to its members. Yeah, just fascinating to see that, how this dynamics and who gets the ability to build the house in that area. And it's fascinating because it was not, let's say, a totally private thing. It was not a kibbutz. You don't have to be a member of some kind of ideology. But if you were not connected to a certain influential group, the chances of you of getting a house in Kochav Yair did not exist. Of course, you can today buy a house in Kochav Yair for quite a nice sum from someone who received almost for free 20 years ago from the government. So this is in a way also how influential groups are able to transform their political capital into financial one as well, but on the long run.
A fascinating story, right? We could just spend the podcast talking about these examples, but I want to move forward because then in chapter 5, you shift and you talk about a different kind of process, suburbanization. So you move from the process of gentrification to the process of suburbanization. And I was wondering if you can tell us more about this process and also the differences between the two.
The gentrification process was also a suburbanization process. What happened afterwards is more, I would call it more a mass suburbanization. Because, let's say, after the area was gentrified, private contractors then could now, you know, take the lead. There's now an economic rationale. It turned into a place where others would like to live in. Therefore, we see that the state now could endorse a more efficient process, something resembling more, let's say, an assembly line. So locating a site of territorial importance, planning it, tendering it, constructing, and then settling. And we see how this also started from, let's say, more suburban settlements, let's say, Soran, Bat Hefer, or Lapid, and then with, you know, private houses, but more, mass produced. So we have, let's say, single dwelling typologies, repetitive construction, repetitive houses, repetitive streets, but still small scale. And eventually these led to the large scale developments that we see that have been built, let's say, since the late 1990s, early 2000s, along the area, let's say, in the extensions of, let's say, Tzur Yitzhak or those were Orthodox town of Elad.
And I just want to ask you to talk a little bit more about Elad and also the other star settlement, Modi'in.
Well, Modi'in and Elad, in a way, they are. Elad is more a statistical anomaly in that sense. It started as, it should have been something quite similar to Kochav Yair. It should have been a settlement of up to 2,500 dwelling units, so 10,000 inhabitants. You know, usually these are very quote-unquote normative families, you know, a man, a woman, two kids, a dog. So dwelling units is usually translated into four inhabitants. So it was supposed to be an additional upper-middle-class secular veteran settlement. During the coalition talks, we're talking about mid-1990s, the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox parties had quite a strong influence. And one of the things that they were able to get from Ariel Sharon, who was now Minister of Infrastructure, if I remember correctly, because you see Ariel Sharon every time gets a different influential role in settlements, other Minister of Defense, Agriculture, and eventually Infrastructure, and then Prime Minister. Now it was Infrastructure, and part of the coalition agreement in order to please their partners for the coalition. He had to surrender the site and turned into a neutral Orthodox town, which is in a way an anomaly. It was then quite strange in the societal composition along with the Green Line. Modi'in it got, let's say, the kick in the 1990s, but the idea of developing Modi'in was much, much older, at least two decades, starting with the 1960s, then 70s, becoming more concrete in the 1980s. I didn't deal with Modi'in too much, but I think that Modi'in would not have been possible without the gentrification and also early mass suburbanization that facilitated its construction, the economic rationale behind it, the demand for housing in that area. And we see that, for example, in the construction of Riout, which is an upper middle class, small scale suburban settlements, then settled by officers. Not only from the Air Force, but with a strong presence of Air Force officers. And it was stated by the government in the decision to construct Riout that it forms as the first step of establishing a city in the area. So we see that by bringing these officers, we should adore years of the aura that they bring with them. They transform this quiet inhabitable space, this quiet frontier area, into a place where a city of, probably at the end, more than 100,000 inhabitants should be built or could be built.
What I found fascinating about Modi'in is also the fact that it's connected to via a very problematic road 443, which in a sense give some respite to the heavy traffic of and surrounding Jerusalem, but it is also connected to sort of political issues. The very fact that it goes through the West Bank and essentially it's for Israeli only, but obviously we're not delving into that. But it really, I think, connecting Modi'in, its development, connecting it with the road, it really shows the complexities of the built-up of Israel. Nothing is essentially non-politicized in the region.
I think that nothing is non-politicized. I think it's perhaps the most accurate thing one could say about construction in Israel. And this was, for me, fascinating because when I was interviewing people living in these settlements, let's say I would interview people who are clearly, they perceive themselves as not right, so left or left-leaning or center-left. They would say we're not ideological. They would also, because they understood more or less what I'm trying to ask, they would initially start by a political statement intended to make me understand that they are not part of, let's say, they're not extremists. Still, that they never, they always found it important to state at some point in the conversation that there is also a Zionist or a territorial importance to them living there. I was always wondering why. And because I was wondering whether these were people who, say, cynically used the territorial enterprise in order to get a good house, or the other way around. And I think that it is impossible to draw the line. Impossible to say this is economical, this is territorial. It is exactly the combination of both that makes it, in a way, into such a successful project.
So in the last chapter, you introducing the economic question, which is discussed throughout the book, but here you really talk about the financialization, which is connected with the privatization of Israeli settlements. Can you speak about this process?
When I talk about financialization, I mean we have something here that is a bit much more complex than just simple construction of new houses and dwelling units and, you know, the selling of dwelling units and the marketing of them. But rather we have here this entangled relationship of investment-driven planning, which starts from large-scale entrepreneurs and then goes all the way to small-scale individuals who are the investors here. So the intention here of the government was to create a market which would attract these large-scale entrepreneurs to build in the area, but also the small-scale investors who would buy the apartments either to rent them out or to live in, and, but with the prospect, you know, of making profits at the end. So we have, in that sense, the settlers turn into real, or let's say, concrete investors or shareholders in this the national territorial process. And I call this the shift between the focus on housing to focus on assets. And this is this difference, I think, is quite important to state. And because this is not an Israeli phenomenon, but rather an international one. We see investment-driven planning all taking place all around the world. It, what we see here now is how it's utilized to serve national and territorial interests. And the scope so this influence has transformed drastically the built environment. And when one sees this also in the urban layout and the replication of the same housing topologies and the repetitive dwelling units. And I think this is what makes, let's say, the area along the Green Line into an extreme case study for privatization.
Now, in this chapter, you focus on Arish. Arish is a very interesting example because today it's probably around a city of 35,000 people, but it's projected to be a city of 100,000 by 2030. And essentially, this demographic growth, it's meant to counterbalance the adjacent Palestinian towns just across the Green Line.
Well, yes, Harish is an extraordinary example for several reasons. So we have to go back a bit in time and see that the Israeli government has been trying to develop a Jewish city in the area of Wadi Ara since the late 1960s, because it's a predominantly Arab area inside Israel, and it's also just adjacent to the West Bank. And so, as we said, the fear of the territorial sequence between, let's say, towns like Kfar Qara or Umm El Fahm, and their, so their ability to then challenge Israeli control of the area is quite large if such a territorial sequence is created. And we see then in archival materials how the choice for Harish was an outcome not of a question of livability or suitability of planning, because there were other sites possible. There was one site, for example, just north of Kfar Qara that was not chosen. So the choice was made mainly due to the ability of the site to stop or to cut off any possible cross-border Arab sequences. But the problem of Harish, if we can call it like that, was that Israel of the 1970s and 80s, when this idea started to emerge, was no longer operating this old socialist manner let's build a city in the middle of nowhere and just put immigrants in it and everything will be fine. There had to be some kind of economic rationale. There was a short-lived kibbutz in the area, and we see that. Mainly we see that starting from the 1980s, that we see this growing emphasis on building a city. But then who would live there? So back then, practically no one. When we say no one, we mean, you know, the main sector, you know, the veteran middle class secular Israeli sector, and this is why, you know, the first attempt to build a city there in the early 1990s was stopped, mainly as the government understood that if it built a city in the area and Jewish Israelis were not probably be interested in coming, that most of the future tenants would actually be Arab families from Wadi Ara. Fearing, let's say, this double-edged sword, for territorial settlement turned Arab by the market, by the free market, the project was stopped. This is why by the early 2000s, or let's say late 1990s or 2000, it was decided then to turn Harish into an ultra-Orthodox city, thinking that this would prevent the site's Arabization. And we see similar initiatives when, let's say, the Israeli hegemon is not interested in a site or a city, then there's a plea to the ultra-Orthodox sector because of its communal formation, because its ability to draw large numbers. So we see that, for example, in Nazareth, in Upper Nazareth, Metropolit, or today called Nof HaGalil. But anyhow, returning to Haritz, what happened is that following the 2011 social justice protests, which focused mainly on the questions of housing and affordability, all of a sudden it was now of interest to the larger Israeli public. And it also then turned into this new frontier for secular middle class that was not able to live in Tel Aviv area, had then to look for new opportunities somewhere else. And it also turned into something that could be given to that middle class as a way to relax them, to soothe them, but to bring them into the national and territorial process by answering their need or their protest for affordable housing.
Can you share with us some of your conclusions?
Well, I try to not to make my conclusions be too much depressing, because we need to remain somehow also optimistic. But I would say that if we rely constantly on the private market to do things, then it will just take over everything, you know, because we see eventually how this homogenization of space is taking place. But we're losing in that sense the way any possibility of creating a livable space. But I think that the main conclusion, which is not that optimistic, is that we see, we usually think of privatization as something that contradicts the state's interests. We usually think, yeah, okay, we have the state and we have the private market, and these are two really, they're totally disconnected and in a way also contradicting. But it's actually the other way around, because there's no real free market. You know, the market is always created by a state. And if they're created by states, they have to serve the interests of the state. And the question is whether we could use the free market to challenge national agendas. And this is something that I'm trying to look at now. So if I was dealing with the idea of privatized colonization, I'm wondering around whether we can speak of privatized decolonization, and whether market-led initiatives could in a way be connected to the idea of, let's say, self-affirmation. But let's say that perhaps the way we see today, as long as we don't have something new on the table, if we just continue with the status quo of planning, and I'm not just speaking about Israel-Palestine, I'm just speaking, let's say, to the larger question of privatization, housing, and territoriality, and national interests, then the space stratification, segregation in terms of, let's say, ethnic segregation, but also economic one, will only increase. This is why we see how this is. We see the growing literature and the concept of neo-apartheid, which is a phenomenon that we see in all around the world, so from Sao Paulo to Beijing, this separation between different classes. And these classes usually have a color. In Israel, they do as well. And the question is, how do we stop them? This is something that, unfortunately, when you're dealing with history, you cannot answer these questions. But let's say that this is a question that has to be on our mind constantly.
This was Gabriel Schwake, author of Dwelling on the Green Line, Privatize and Rule in Israel-Palestine, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Renato. Really, I enjoyed it.